Well, great to visit with you guys, and appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to getting to know you a bit better. Well, this is kind of an afterthought, but I asked Wally on the way in from the airport this morning if he thought you might be interested in just seeing some slides about the experiences that I've had in India and in the work there. It is a kind of an appropriate thing. I often say when I talk about India and the gospel work that I've done there, that one of the things that the apostles did when they came back from their trip preaching the gospel in Asia Minor was they went back to the church at Antioch, and when they were coming and gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. So it's encouraging for us to know about what brethren are doing in other places. So I actually went to India for the first time in the 1970s. I went in 1975 with my whole family. I was a Fulbright professor over there for 1 year at a university called Allahabad University. And then I went back to Hyderabad in 1993, and my wife and I lived there for 2 years while I was the director of the American Studies Research Center in Hyderabad, which is a U.S. State Department research facility that was, it was a quite interesting kind of job that I stayed in for 2 years. But India is a huge country. I'll try to leave a little time. What time am I going to finish here?
You'll hear the first bell at 20:25.
Okay.
Quarter over that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll try to time this. You know, there's so many things about India that I won't be able to tell you. Just in a short presentation. It's a huge country, more than 1 billion people, about 1.1 billion people. India will, by all projections, become the most populous country in the world in about another 15 years, surpassing China, because the Chinese have some grip on controlling the population. The Indians have absolutely none. So Hyderabad is the fourth largest city in India, has a population of about 8 million people. And so it's in this state. This is the state of Andhra Pradesh. I did learn to speak the language that they speak there. The language is Telugu. It's a South Indian language. And the bad news is it's only spoken in that one state. Indians speak a lot of different languages. They speak 18 major languages. They speak over 200 languages. But in the South, in each state, they speak a different language, and Telugu is spoken only in this state. The good news is there are 100 million people in that state, so there are a lot of people to talk to. But anyhow, I'll show you what Telugu sounds like in just a few minutes. I was just would tell you that the reason I was there and the reason we lived there for 2 years, which puts things in different perspective. If you live in a place, it's different from just going and visiting. You get to know the people a lot better. That's another advantage of learning the language as well, is you can talk to everybody and not to just a few people that speak English. Now, we think all Indians speak English. Of course, most of them don't. Only about 2% of Indians speak English. If you go over there, the ones you run into will speak English, and of course, the ones that are over here that I expect you have some Indians around here who are doctors, and they all are quite bright and speak English. And many times Americans will say to me, well, the Indians are really smart, aren't they? You know, my doctor's an Indian, the engineers are Indians, and so on. And then my answer always is, well, the ones over here are smart. If you'd like to meet some dumb ones, just come go to India with me. And I could introduce some others to you. But about 2% speak English, by the way. Only about 2% of Indians are Christians. That is, in the broadest definition of Christian, Roman Catholics and Protestants and all kinds of Christians. About 12 or 13% are Muslims, and about 80% of the Indians are Hindus. Well, anyhow, here's what I was doing there. I was the director of this American Studies Center, which the United States State Department built a big library and conference center in India with the largest library about America outside of the United States. The director is an American Fulbright professor, so I applied back in 1993 and got that job and was able to go there and live for 2 years. We did all kinds of conferences. We bring university professors from all over Asia and Africa there who talked about America, either literature or history or whatever. And we'd do conferences and they would do research in this library. These are just pictures of the conferences. They also sent me a lot of different places. That's in Bangladesh and Indonesia, China, where I would conduct conferences about American religion, basically. Well, what the thing that I have discovered in trying to work in foreign countries and in the gospel, and by the way, the reason I applied for this position was not because I wanted to go to India as a scholar, but because I wanted to go to India to see if I could help in the churches that were emerging over there, so, some of whom I met back in the 1970s when I went. This is a family that I've worked with in the last 15 years. I'll be going back again in July, along with a good many other men. But this old brother, Brother Judson, who died about 5 years ago, was a good, honest, honorable man, and these are some of his family and friends that he introduced me to. I began studying with him. That old brother Judson, he had a stroke shortly before he died, and we kind of had a patriarchal meeting there. In our time there, my wife and I worked with and tried to help develop a congregation. We started meeting with this brother Benson in a suburb of Hyderabad called Mullally. And this is my son-in-law, Russ Roberts, who lives in Annandale, Virginia. We did an outdoor meeting with these folks. There were about 25 of them. But they asked me if I would help them try to start a congregation. So here's one of the stories that is an ongoing story in India. By 1998, we went back. I'd kind of helped them raise some money to buy a piece of property and build a building. We had a building under construction at that point. See these cars here? That in the 1990s, that was the only kind of car that you could buy in India. India's changed a lot in recent years. It's called an ambassador. It was the world's worst car. And it would absolutely beat you to death to ride in it. But here were people coming to this meeting in the unfinished structure. Now, that's the way most of them come to services. That's an auto rickshaw. And they still do. Most of them come in an auto rickshaw. I have no idea what the world's record is for how many people can get in an auto rickshaw. But I have a good testimony of more than 20. So, Indians can stand close contact with one another that Americans can't stand. I've had a lot of people ask me about these buildings and say, well, how many people will that building hold? And my answer usually is whether it'll hold about 150 Americans or 300 Indians. Because the Indians in the first place are about half the size of Americans. Well, here they are singing in that congregation in 2001. It's as you'll notice in all of these pictures, the women sit on one side, the men sit on another, the other side. That's just a cultural matter. The sexes are still separated. That's true of young people. They don't date. Every time I take a young American preacher with me to India, I tell him, now put your sermon on dating up, since they don't date over here. Their marriages are still, by and large, arranged, which, by the way, makes more sense than our system. And I told my children when we came back that I thought we would adopt the Indian system of getting married, but it didn't work. Well, this is that congregation in 2004. Hard to get a picture of all of them, but by that point, this is a group where we began meeting with about 25 people in a house. They had 120 people. I backed up a little bit to take that picture to get the scenery in the front yard. Everybody has a water buffalo or two in their front yard. This is in a pretty good suburb in Hyderabad. You preach with a translator. I still actually preach with a translator, although I can talk to people, because the Bible language is a kind of a particular language. It's a specialized language. And furthermore, you want to actually be pretty sure you're really saying what you mean to say. So this is Brother Benson. This is David Owen. Some of you might know David, preaching, and Brother Benson translating. This is a more recent picture. I always like this picture, however, because I was speaking, and as you will notice this weekend, I am slightly dependent in my preaching on a sense of humor. And sometimes a sense of humor is hard to get across language barriers. And sometimes I'll say some very funny things. Nobody laughs in India. But anyhow, on this occasion it worked. Now, this congregation, since we've helped them get started, they're totally independent now. And everything they've done, they've gotten their pews and carpets and these light fixtures. They did all that themselves without anybody helping them. They're pretty gaudy and ugly, but they're theirs. This congregation now supports five men themselves. They get no support from the United States. And that is where you want to get in a place like India, is something that doesn't exist just because Americans are sending money to it, but because they've got the message and they want to be self-sufficient congregations themselves. So these are some really able fellows. That's a picture of a group of, each year we will have classes with preachers when we go over. This is a group of the preachers recently. Well, here, just quickly, I'm going to go through these slides about some other congregations. This is another congregation in the same city. That's my wife and I meeting with them in one of the members' homes in 1994. It's called the Balanagar Congregation. This is their building that they had begun by 1998. All of the buildings in India, you have to have, they dedicate them, and this is old Brother Judson dedicating, cutting the ribbon for the Balanagar building. That's his son's and son-in-law's. There it is in 2003. We built an upper story 3 years ago, and Brother Judson was dead, so I had to cut the ribbon. And it's a nice building. They meet upstairs. There are about 130 people in this congregation now, and they support three men. There I am preaching, and Brother Benson translating for me. There's some of the men that have gone with me through the years. Two of them are listening, and two don't seem to be. This is the ladies' side. It's hard to take a picture of this whole congregation, but this is the ladies' side. This is Brother Surrender, the preacher, and his family. There I am preaching with Surrender translating. These people like to make banners. And so everywhere we go, they'll have banners. And I generally get star billing. And Alan Cornett. They don't spell our names very well. We don't spell their names very well either. Okay, that's what Telugu looks like in writing, by the way. I can't read it because it's a very complicated, extensive book, an alphabet that I've not tried to learn. That's the old baptistry there. I'm going to go through these. I have some of these slides in here simply because I've given this presentation at places where people know something about these groups. This is a group about 30 miles outside of Hyderabad called Momenpet. There's a group of their members who attended one of our classes, and they wanted me to help them try to get a building. So in 2004, we held a tent meeting there. There I am, Dr. David Ed Harold, Alan Cornett, and Jason. That's Jason Cicero. We told Jason that he was so famous that he could go just by one name, like Madonna, you know, or something like that. Well, anyhow, they had a building started by the next year. We inaugurated it. This is a good congregation. It probably has 175 people now and is a pretty self-sufficient group. This was the old congregation that the old man, Brother Judson, preached at when we went there. It was an old village. It took about 45 minutes to get there, 45 tough minutes to get there. And they had this old long building. It was a congregation of about 250 people, but only about half of them could get in that building. And this was the taking the Lord's Supper one Sunday. And you can see this long shotgun building. Taking the Lord's Supper was a kind of a test of faith in these villages because they're not one cuppers, they were about 10 cuppers. And so what they would do is they would keep refilling these cups, and as far as I could tell, the cups never got washed. Until one day, I saw them. They did take the cups out and they washed them. They washed them in the baptistry where we had baptized some pretty dirty people. And furthermore, it didn't make much difference because what was left over at the end just got poured back into the jug and used the next time. But now I'm very careful about what I eat and my health while I'm in India, and I've never really been sick since the 70s, nor anybody that goes with me, because I tell them exactly what they can eat and what they can't eat. But I figure if you get sick, take in the Lord's Supper, so be it. Well, here, these people love to talk with me out in the yard, since I can speak Telugu. And I don't know if you can pick me out in that picture or not. But they would stand out there and talk to me all day if I would. So these men from this village congregation talking with me about trying to help them build a building. And we got that started in 2000. And there it is, 2001. We had a big kind of tent meeting with 1,600 people who attended. There are a lot of interesting kind of side things I tell you about this. The volume is asking me if we have any trouble, if there's any persecution or anything like that. And the answer is, not really. Occasionally there is, but generally what we try to do is just stay out of the way. And Americans, I feel pretty free to go wherever if we, you know, just don't make a big show out of it. So like when we did this huge meeting, I told these fellows, I said, well, we'll come out there. Yeah. Sorry about my voice, you guys, but this is Alan. Every time I go to some new place, I get it. But anyhow, every time we go to someplace like this, we tell them, okay, we'll come. Just don't make a big to-do out of Americans being here, because we're not supposed to be doing this. So they said, okay, no problem. So when we drove up to this meeting, we got out, they had loudspeakers all over that town. And over the last week, they said, the Americans are here. So they didn't get the message too well. Well, okay, that's another picture, that building. There I am. I do kind of stand out, right? These are all preachers who go out of this village church and the other villages in the afternoon. Like if one of their members will marry somebody in another village, they'll go and try to get a congregation started there. Well, these are just some of the other congregations where we visited, and I won't try to talk about any of them. This congregation has a real narrow little lot, so they have a 3-story building. I've helped them build 19 buildings. Buildings are useful for them. They're useful in a number of ways. They give them a sense of stability, but also because of the caste system, which I don't have time to talk with you about, but it's, of course, a rigid system of separation that people from a higher caste will not come into the house. Or somebody of a lower caste. Almost all of the Christians in India are untouchables. And they're the lowest, really non-caste people. And there are a lot of them. They're nearly a majority of Indians. But if you're meeting in an untouchable's house, people from high caste won't come to the house. They'll come to a public meeting place. And consequently, the meeting place is have been very useful in that regard. Now, they also give a sense of stability to these people. And we have converted quite a few high-caste people. They have. They do almost all of the converting. The Indian preachers are a lot better than American preachers. Now, a lot of American preachers go with me, and the first time they go, they'll always say, well, now, what do these Indians know? How much do they know? And my answer usually is, well, probably just slightly more than you do. It is easy to underestimate these people. Many of them are very bright, and they are very knowledgeable in the scriptures. So they're the ones that do most of the work. All right. Now, most of what we do is when I go in July, we will do classes for preachers. And this is the old original place we met, in an old hotel that was just a dump. It's been torn down now. But we bring these preachers in. They come in now from all over India. And we're working now with churches from all over the country. And there's David Owen, David Barnes from San Jose, California. I got PowerPoint now. So I took up a projector several years ago, and we can PowerPoint. Probably PowerPoint, of course, is only probably 10 people that we work with have English copy. And so if we're really going to use PowerPoint, I have to have them translated into television so they can read it. Or now we're dealing with people in a lot of different languages, so it really does complicate it. These are the classes we meet in. I spend actually most of my time just talking one-on-one with the Indian preachers, particularly since I can talk with them in Telugu. But this, for instance, this young man here, whose name is Raju, he's a computer programmer. He has an excellent job. He's a member of that Moana congregation. He'll sit with me to be sure we get everything straight. So, well, here's just some of the other places that we're working now. This young man preaches in Bangalore. Bangalore is the high-tech center in India. If you dial Dell computer assistance, you'll talk to somebody in Bangalore. And if you are not knowing how to speak Indian English, I will be teaching you how. But I always ask them where they are. So this is in Bangalore. This is where this young man meets in his house. Has a room fixed up in his house. That's Bangalore. Those are preachers in Bangalore. That's a great big congregation. That's a Tamil-speaking congregation. Okay, let me flip on through this. These are all in my gloss, or Chennai, as it's called today. And these are classes conducted there. This young man is from up in the northeast of India, up in Shillong. And we're working with groups up there now. As you can see, they look kind of Burmese. This is a very smart young guy whose IQ is probably higher than anybody else that goes over there. Well, okay, this is a group in Delhi. And they're almost all Northeasterners. There I am teaching in Delhi. This man and his wife are both doctors in Delhi, and they're kind of the cornerstone to that congregation that we were working with there. Well, these are just some of the preachers that have gone with me in recent years. You might see somebody you recognize there. I'm just going to flip on through this. Here's some Indian scenes. That's Indians on the road. Hyderabad has about 50% Muslims, and so you see a lot of Muslim women there. Traffic in India is pretty bad. This is on the way to that village church that I was showing you. It takes about 45 minutes to get there. Because you might run into an obstacle car. Yeah. There are about 250-300 million Indians now middle class. And middle class means they're probably earning somewhere from $100 a month to $600 or $700 a month. But nonetheless, it is a substantial middle class. About 700,000 Indians are still living in the semi-stone age. And how they're ever going to acclimate all those people is the real issue in that society. Oh, that's some of the traffic, too. So you have to calculate your travel time with a lot of things in consideration. This is McDonald's, boys and girls. So you can always stop and get a snack if you want to die early. otherwise, you're ready to take a pass on McDonald's. I take a lot of peanut butter crackers with me. And actually, in the good hotels, we study in decent hotels now. You can eat in the hotel if you select what you eat. In the general rule, in any society like that, if you can't cook it or peel it, don't eat it. So you can't eat anything raw. But here we are, kind of, at our favorite Chinese restaurant. I don't batch out a lot of people. I serve just three or four young people. This is Brother Vincent's son. His name is Wrighty. Wrighty's now in college. He's studying for an engineer's degree. He translates for us. But I baptized him. This is Brother Vincent's nephew, whose father died, and was called Sonny. He legally changed his name about 4 or 5 years ago, and his name now is David Edmund. So he changed his name to my name. But he's a fine young man too. He's in college. This is one of the daughters. Here's what television sounds like when you baptize somebody. Here's what you say. Tundri, Mariyu, Kumaradu, Mariyu, Parashut Atma, Paradise. That's Father and Son and Holy Spirit in the name of. Ni Papa Shama Pana Koraku. That's your sins forgiven for. Nainu, Niku, Baptismaru, Espinaga. That's I to you, baptism, and give. Languages are fun. They're kind of interesting, the way you say things in language. You want to ask somebody in India, better if he's married, you say, Miku Periayanda, that is, to you has marriage happened. And I thought, that's kind of funny. Now, it actually does just happen to him. But the more I thought about it, it kind of just happens to you over here, too. So, it's an interesting phraseology. But baptism is the same. Actually, kind of what you say in television, that I am now to you giving baptism. We have a very activistic view of baptism, and that is baptism is something I do. What baptism?
Yeah.
Something that I do. And it's a decision that I make. But what is very pertinent about it is it's something that God did for us. And it's something that God gives to us. So it's good for us to get that sense that they kind of get out of the language that when I baptize into Christ, it is God giving me the forgiveness of my sins and entry into his family. It's a gift of God. So, only good for us to think about that. Sonny, David Edwin, and Lighty more recently, because they've grown up, and Benson's daughter and his wife. That's a recent class that we had. Okay, I thought I'd try to get through with that and see. Anybody have a question that you'd like to ask me about India? Yes.
You had a big very structure as far as the classes and so forth. How is that when you preach about it? Because I don't respect the person.
Yeah, the Christians, by and large, understand it. And so, once people become Christians, they recognize that they're giving up any kind of caste ideology that they have. Caste is actually illegal in India. Constitutionally, they can't practice it, but everybody practices. And you're born into a caste. And consequently, people still marry within their caste by and large. But now Christians understand that it should not be that way. It's very hard to remove prejudices that are that deeply ingrained in a society. Hard to get them out. You know, we have prejudices. They run fairly deep, but we're just novices compared to the Indians. I mean, they've been practicing caste prejudice for 4,000 years. So to tell them all of a sudden, well, you should not worry about that, is difficult. But there are high caste Hindus who have become Christians. My daughter-in-law is a Christian that was converted while we were over there. She was a scholar at this center where I was, and my son came over and visited, and 5 days later they came in and told me, now this young woman had been going to services. She was a Brahmin, but she liked my wife and I, she'd been going to services lately. And so my son and this woman, who's a beautiful young woman, came in and said, we want to talk with you for a minute. So Molly decided she wants to be baptized. And I said, oh, very good. You know, I knew she'd been working on that. But I knew another shoe was about to drop. And so then they said, we decided we want to get married. Well, now for an Indian, that is not that hard. That they would just, you know, make a deal. It takes a pretty peculiar American man to do that, which is what my son is. So anyhow, so they live in Tampa, and she's a, she has a PhD. She came to the United States as a Fulbright scholar. I was the chairman of the committee before she ever met my son. And there were like 2,000 applicants, and she was rated second. So anyhow, there are success stories. And people that overcome that caste system, mostly among this new generation of kind of middle class young people who are living in more modern conditions and so on. And so they give up that. Her parents had her arranged, but for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. And once she then got away, but her father was a college professor too, so he's slightly more modern. But it was an unusual thing for them in those circumstances. Let me tell you one other quick little story about my daughter-in-law. When she first came to visit us in Auburn, I was teaching at Auburn University in Alabama, and Auburn was a fine church that is mostly kind of country guys. And then, you know, the churchyard was mostly pickup truck. And so this girl comes in her sorority, and she's out of the song. A bunch of the men were standing back at the back. One of them said to me, he said, "Does she speak English?" And I said, "Slightly better than anybody else here." Because she actually was a scholar. Well, okay. What else? Any other questions? Yes.
Is there a high level of
persecution in the church? Not really. And the not really because, you know, there's so much going on in India. There's so many people that almost entirely everything that's going on is below the radar. And the animosity of Hindus against Christians is relatively low level because the tension is mostly between Muslims and Hindus. And Christians are pretty passive, not assertive. But now there has been some. There is a Hindu nationalist political party that I'm happy to say in this election that just took place a few weeks ago, just badly defeated. And they do burn churches on occasion. So there's always a potential there. And what we try to do when we go as Americans, Indians by and large don't have much to fear from practicing their Christianity. The Hindus don't like conversions. But what we never, I've been in a place or two when I felt a little bit in jeopardy because of what I was doing. But I'll try to direct our young men on the kind of things that they need to not do, to draw attention. Not because we might be persecuted, but because we might cause trouble to the media. Right. Any other questions? Yes?
Was it very difficult to teach them out of Hinduism? It's like the new converts, still hold on.
It's, yes, it is difficult, but now these Indian preachers we work with are very good at it. It is not difficult to convince a Hindu about the grandeur of the story of Jesus. The problem with a Hindu is if you tell him the story of Jesus, he just thinks, oh, that's wonderful, I just add that to everything else that I've got here, because it's an infinitely tolerant kind of religion that you really have to start where Paul starts in Athens, that I am here to tell you about not a God, but the God that made the world and everything.
But these presidents do a good job because they're their neighbors. Yeah. Any of them that come to a service are in France. And so they are quite successful in teaching their neighbors. But they do a lot better job than I do. And so my answer usually is, if somebody says, well, how do you teach a Hindu? I say, I'll go get an Indian preacher. Yeah.
Is there just one Hindu belief system, or do they have thousands of variations?
Good question that I will pick up in my course on comparative religion. The answer is, it is almost impossible to define Hindu belief. And there are probably only three or four ideas that are universally accepted by Hindus. The ideas of reincarnation, karma, dharma. But beyond that, the gods you worship, there are literally hundreds of thousands of gods that people commit themselves to. And the mythologies that are out there are just vast. So, to convert a Hindu is a matter of convincing him that the God of the Bible is the only God. In the United States, by the way, most Indians are not very good Hindus. Many of them are practicing, but most of them are not. They become better Hindus when they come over here because it's a part of their culture, it's part of their Hindu. But no, Hinduism is almost impossible to succinctly define. Did I tell them what? Okay, thanks.